I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll end today with the final installment in our series, The Sounds of America. This month, we've been profiling a selection of the latest picks to enter the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. Each year, 25 recordings are chosen to be preserved for all time in the registry. Newscasts, speeches, music, native languages, sporting events. The registry safeguards the audio heritage of our country. Today, it's the story of Cheap Trick at Budokan. This 1978 live album was originally released solely to the Japanese public. The record company thought they might sell 50,000 copies, and they did. But before long, expensive imported versions of the album started showing up in the United States. The album sold so well, the record company decided to release it in America. And 9 years later, it was certified triple platinum, selling over 3 million copies. To tell the story of Cheap Trick at Budokan, we have the historian.
My name is Waka Anwusa, and I am the curator and director of curatorial affairs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
The author?
I'm Michael Burdash. I'm a professor at the University of Chicago, and I'm the author of Sayonara America, Sayonara Nippon, a geopolitical prehistory of J-pop.
And two members of the band that will be preserved for all time in the National Recording Registry.
I'm Rick Nielsen, guitar player, songwriter for Cheap Trick.
My name is Tom Peterson, and I'm the bass player for Cheap Trick. It's really such an honor and so proud to be a part of it. And it's really the biggest thing I think that's happened to us. It's shocking to me.
All right, Tokyo!
And I think they've made a big mistake. I don't know.
Are you ready?
God, if we knew it was going to be this successful, we'd have put more thought into it.
Thing that people gravitate to towards Cheap Trick is the guys have their own distinct style, and that alone takes that guard down of making you feel like you need to associate with a certain genre, a certain type of look, fashion. I mean, you have Rick Nielsen, guitarist, who is super quirky. I mean, wearing a number of baseball caps at a time. And then you get to Robin Zander, you know, vocalist, rhythm guitar player, who is super giving you this glam rock type of vibe. Then if you look at Tom, bassist for the band, I mean, you're getting just these really cool new wave kind of punk feel. And then, come on, then you get to Bunny, who is, you know, wearing a button up or just, you know, kind of looking like a scientist or one of your science middle school teachers.
Tom Peterson, the bass player, and I were in a band together in high school. He was a guitar player originally, but to play with me, he switched over to bass. I've been playing with Tom longer than I've been married, and I've been married 50 years.
Rick and I went to see the group Slade. And, you know, we love Slade, and they were really funny. They had a crazy stage show, and they were kind of doing everything. And I turned to Rick, and I said, wow, these guys, they're just doing every Cheap Trick in the book.
And I said, Cheap Trick, you know, we were always looking for something, a common name. So Cheap Trick, I said, well, that's a good name. So that was the beginning of Cheap Trick. We came out a time when disco was king and punk was starting to come in. We weren't any of that. We were four guys from Rockford, Illinois that wanted to play music. I never moved from where I was. I mean, I lived other places. I lived in Philadelphia, I lived in Europe, but I always came back to where my family was. I'm an only child, so it's like I didn't have anybody that I had to get back to, but my parents were great, but they weren't what I wanted to do. I met my father, an opera singer, and sang with Billy Graham. And I wanted to play rock music like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles.
We'd been working in clubs so long, we played all the time since we were 15 years old. Not together since we were 15, but, you know, in whatever, rec teen nights and whatever it was. And eventually you're old enough to get a fake ID and, you know, be able to work in nightclubs.
We were playing every place we could, bars, dances, schools, this, that, the other.
This band has toured hundreds of times, thousands of times, actually, over 5,000 times this band has played. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, they slummed it in the Rust Belt states, playing to every club, tavern known to man.
You know, we'd already built kind of a following in the Midwest. Our first record came out, we got a call from Queen and asked us to do the work with them. So we'd play Madison, Wisconsin, and play Milwaukee at the, you know, the good big places. At those shows, the Japanese press, who loved Queen because they were huge over there, they liked us too. And then later that same year, we got asked to go out and tour with Kiss. And Kiss was the same way. The Japanese press were there to see them and because they loved them. But they also liked us too, and they kept writing more about us. Before you knew it, by the end of 77, we were getting so much fan mail, and our records were doing well in Japan. And we went over, and we had every show we did was sold out. We did two shows at Budokan, and we did about maybe 8 or 10 more shows all over the country.
People always said to us, oh, well, those guys, they've had this master plan. Basically, the master plan was, how do we get food? Do we have a motel tonight? You know, when we started, we were considering getting a keyboard player to kind of fill out the sound. This is totally true. The reason we did not get a keyboard player was we looked at each other and go, we get a keyboard player, who's going to ride in the middle?
The real big turning point is 1966 when the Beatles come to Japan and do their first and only appearances in Japan. And that's the first time there are concerts at that scale of 8,000 to 9,000 people in the audience. And that was when the Budokan suddenly transformed into the prestige venue in Japan for a rock band to perform in. The Beatles' visit in 1966 was a turning point.
Your coming to Japan has been referred to by the Japanese press as the arrival of the Beatles typhoon. Can you think of anything, the connection between the two, or do you?
There's probably more wind from the press than from us.
How do you feel? Anyway?
Is that
performing?
No.
Under such elaborate and pretentious security measures.
The thing is that if the security is strict, then it's probably best for us and the people as well. But sometimes it's too strict. But the best situation is when it's just strict enough so that nobody gets hurt.
To play the Budokan is to demonstrate that you have a certain kind of status. And so since 1966, every Japanese band worth its salt wants to play a concert at Budokan. And many touring Western bands, Led Zeppelin played there in 1971, Deep Purple in 72, Chicago in 72.
Sure, we have the story about the Beatles, and we can tell that to our best ability, you know, about how Beatlemania hit the United States. But to have Cheap Trick then go overseas and do that same very thing, it's like we have an American band that did that exact thing in Tokyo. The girls, the screaming, throwing flowers at the plane. That's total trick mania for sure. It's I mean, it's actually a beautiful story that I don't think gets a lot of shine and recognition, obviously, because it didn't happen here. But we have an American band, Cheap Trick, that did just that and created such tidal waves that then boomeranged back here in the United States.
It's formerly called Nippon Budokan. It was built for the Tokyo Olympics in 1964. It was the host of the judo competition. It's a really interesting building. It's a modernist style building, but it also has elements from Japanese traditional architecture.
We never even saw Budokan itself until years later, because we were transported around in like armored cars. So we were just lying in the back of an armored car with no windows, sliding around in the back. Everywhere you went, you basically, your life was in danger, because people would just panic and just start pounding on the cars, and we'd have to lie on the floor in the cars and have the bodyguards put their feet on us so the fans wouldn't realize we were in those vehicles, even though they always seemed to know. It's stressful because you can't do anything. You can't sightsee. We couldn't even look out. One time, Rob and I looked out of the window of the hotel. We saw the fans down in the street, and they saw us, and people ran across the street in front of buses. We were always joking, like, yeah, okay, this is really great. You know, great. You know, the people are going wild, and all this is fantastic. But then, you know, we knew that when we were done, we'd go back, and there we were again at Shakey's Pizza Parlor in Bettendorf, Iowa, or whatever we were doing, because we weren't successful. You made me cry when you said goodbye, that is safe. But tears by a grave. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. I am just so blown away by their energy and passion, you know, in looking at the one song that was not written by the band, Ain't That a Shame, and looking at, you know, Fats Domino's version versus the Cheap Trick version.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame.
Actually, on my wall in my studio, I have the original Ain't It a Shame for Fats Domino from 1955, the gold record. His manager came to us when we were playing in Salt Lake City, says, Fats loves your version. Here's a copy. Because back in 55, I guess they only made one for the artist and one for the producer. I don't know which one we got. We got one of them. We drew straws, and I got had the right straw.
Oh, well, goodbye.
Although I'll cry in that shame, but tears fell.
He had no real reason to do Ain't That a Shame, except we needed to pad the set, I think. You know, at Budokan wasn't a studio record, it's a live album, so that's an unusual type of record to have as a hit. That's not normal. Usually live albums are greatest hits records for artists, which is what it was, because it was really meant just for the Japanese audience. It was just recorded and released as a Japanese record for the Japanese fans, because those songs were hits, a lot of them on there. So it was the greatest hits everywhere else in the world. No one had ever heard any of those songs.
Live at Budokan is just so pivotal to our culture, live performances in general, live rock concerts in general. This ranks at the top of that.
In Japan, people over there, they learned English from listening to rock music, and ours was something that, thank God, that they got some good English lessons from us. And I tell people, it's like, well, we've never really grown, in a way, but luckily where we've started was kind of a good place, and we never tried to be something that we weren't. And so what you see is what you get. You know, it's like, getting in the registry and the Library of Congress, it's like, you know, just look at all the people that are in there. It's like, what an honor. I mean, what an honor to be chosen, to be in there, to still doing what you like to do. I mean, I still like to play music. And it's like, you know, we say that the Budokan made us famous, but we made the Budokan famous. So it's like hard work and do what you like. What a great combination. Us in the Library of Congress. It's an honor, and we'll try not to do anything too bad.
You just heard the voices of Rick Nielsen and Tom Peterson of Cheap Trick, along with Michael Burdash of the University of Chicago and Waka Onwusa from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They helped us tell the story of Cheap Trick at Budokan. That album is one of 25 recordings chosen this year to be preserved in the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. The Sounds of America is produced by Ben Manila and Jenny Cataldo for BMP Audio with support from the National Recording Registry.